Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Today, we are opening the lines to find out what you want to hear on our One Planet shows in the coming months. We will continue to focus on a wide range of issues like plastic pollution, the oil industry, and how activists and communities across the country are mobilizing to fight the climate crisis and Trump's dangerous climate agenda. But today we want to hear from you. You can join us by calling 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. What would you like us to focus on that is happening in your communities that we need to know about? What about what's happening at the state level, nationally, and then internationally? When you look at what's happening with the Trump administration, according to the NRDC, since he took office in January of last year, the administration has taken or proposed at least 400 actions that directly threaten the environment, climate, and human health. Joining us to talk about the state of the environment and what is really needed in media coverage is Mark Hertzgaard, environment correspondent for The Nation and executive director of Covering Climate Now, a global journalism initiative committed to more and better coverage of the climate story. Hi, Mark. Thanks so much for joining us again, and Happy New Year.
Hi, Rose. Happy New Year to you. It's always good to be back on KALW.
Well, it's great to have you back, Mark. Because things are pretty dire out there when it comes to the climate crisis, I wonder if you can talk about some positive news. And Kevin, I'm hearing myself. If there's a button you can push, that would be great. Thank you. I just wanted to start, Mark, by focusing on an action that the Sierra Club is planning. It's Make Polluters Pay. And there's going to be a number of actions across the country starting on January 21st. They're going to have a virtual action hour on Thursday, January 15th that anyone can join. They say oil and gas companies are making record profits while we pay the price of the climate chaos they cause. And so they're putting together a wide variety of community forums. There's going to be evenings. There's students uniting. Things happening all across the country. So I wanted to let listeners know about that because there's so much activism happening out there that we don't always hear about. So I'm just wondering what really strikes you right now that's more positive on these issues that we need to know about?
I'm glad you brought up those actions that are planned by the Sierra Club. And I would take it one step further. It's really important for those actions and anyone who cares about climate and the environment to be part of the larger citizen pushback against what's coming out of Washington. And just this weekend, there were hundreds of demonstrations across the country that were more focused on ICE and the deplorable murder of Rene Good in Minneapolis. And you know, a lot of other people have been killed by ICE too. Here in New York City, I was covering the march yesterday, and one of the faith leaders read off the names of, I think it's 32 individuals who the faith leader claimed had been killed by ICE in the course of 2025 and so far in 2026. There is a lot of agitation across the country that we've seen in these marches, which have been growing in size and diversity since they began back last February, shortly after Trump took office. We've now had three of these so-called No Kings marches. They've gotten bigger and bigger each time. I've covered a couple of them here in New York. And I've noticed each time, you know, sadly, frankly, that there's almost no presence at those marches from environmental groups or climate groups. And I think that is an opportunity that people need to realize. You need to be part of a larger movement in order to counter what's coming out of the White House. The White House's climate denial, its attack on environmental standards, you know, these are not separate from the rest of its agenda. And it is one of the lessons of history is that you have a stronger chance of winning as a popular movement if you have a broader popular movement.
I'm glad you brought up the ICE protests, Mark, because they did take place across the country. The LA Times reports that there were 60 just in California. I read that there were thousands in Marin, thousands in Santa Rosa, happening all across the country. What are your thoughts, Mark, about where the climate movement is right now? I was really struck just thinking about this show. The Washington Post had a piece in November called The Big Issue Democrats Have Stopped Talking About. They looked at lawmakers' appearances and social media posts on the Democratic side and showed that they're mostly going quiet on climate. But at the same time, you've got these actions coming up, make polluters pay. But then, as you said, when you go to some of these other actions, you rarely see environmental groups there. So, what are you making of this moment we're in?
It's so interesting you're asking that, Rose. That happens to be exactly the piece that I'm writing this week for the Covering Climate Now newsletter, which is called The Climate Beat. And everyone is invited to subscribe to that. It's free. Just go to our website, coveringclimatenow.org. And it also runs every Thursday in The Nation. And we're going to, Nation Magazine, and we're going to be talking about this idea that is gaining some degree of currency within the Democratic Party that now is not the time to talk about climate change. And it's a requires a certain kind of magical thinking to believe that the way to solve a problem is to not talk about it. And yet that seems to be, I wouldn't say it has necessarily taken hold yet entirely within the Democratic Party, but there are definitely strong voices around and inside, and people like Matt Iglesias, who's a sort of a pundit, Democratic Party aligned pundit who's been arguing this, including in the pages in the New York Times. I think frankly, it's quite wrong. And the basic category error that is made there, when you talk to these people, they say, well, they fall back on an argument of realism. Realism requires us to not talk about climate, let's talk about affordability. First of all, there's two categories, actually. One is that, we can chew gum and walk at the same time. You can talk about affordability and climate at the same time. In fact, they are very closely aligned, as the Rhode Island Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse has been saying for months now. But the deeper category error is to think that when you talk about realism, they conflate what they take to be political realism with scientific realism. And scientific realism says that we've long passed the time when we could wait to deal with climate change. We are racing towards tipping points on this planet that will be irreversible. And it is both simply wrong and quite arrogant, frankly, of these pundits and the people inside of the sort of centrist Democratic Party conversations around this in Washington to think that their definition of what is or is not politically realistic is somehow going to overtake the science realism. Physics does not compromise. It doesn't know how to compromise. And that's obviously very different in politics. So I think we have to be very clear-eyed about all that. And this is not the time to not talk about climate change. Because let's remember, 74% of the country want the government to take stronger climate action. And that number comes out of the 89% project that Covering Climate Now has been doing over the last year. 80 to 89% of the people around the world want their governments to take stronger action. Here in the United States, the number's a little lower, 74%, but that's still three people out of four. If we were covering an election, in the press, somebody who wins by 60% of the vote, we call that a landslide. Well, 74% want their government to take stronger climate action here in the United States. That's a super landslide. So the idea that somehow we should not talk about that, or any politician should not talk about that, frankly, is wrong on the facts.
Well, this is going to be interesting to see how this plays out, especially in the midterms, Mark, because this Washington Post piece writes about the Searchlight Institute, which is a new think tank founded by Adam Gentleson, who worked with Senator John Fetterman and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. And the Searchlight Institute has urged Democrats to obey, quote, the first rule about solving climate change, don't say climate change. This is so strange. Why are they doing this, do you think?
I'm not going to speculate about why they're doing it. I can't get inside their heads. I would prefer to give them the benefit of the doubt. They think that this will win elections. And look, they could be right, but whether they're right about what is politically realistic or whether they're wrong about what's politically realistic, the bottom line point holds. Scientific realism trumps, pardon the expression, trumps political realism every day of the week. And so our challenge as citizens and their challenge as office holders and electeds and people trying to get people elected is to figure out a way to make the political reality match up with the scientific reality, because it ain't going to happen the other way around. That we know. And I've been on the climate beat long enough to remember the last time that we had this conversation about whether you can use the word climate. And that was during the Barack Obama presidency in his first year in 2009. And people inside the White House were saying, don't use the word climate. Don't. It turns people off. You can talk about clean energy. And Bill McKibben, of course, our colleague, the dean of climate writers in the United States, pointed out at the time what I said at the top of this broadcast. It is magical thinking to believe that you can solve a problem that you do not name. The only way that an interest group as powerful as the fossil fuel industry, which has been working hand in glove with the United States government for 100 years, the only way they can be defeated about something like this is with a massive popular movement. And you have got to then explain to the public what the reason for that movement is, that we are facing a climate emergency, that the science is very dire, but that the solutions are abundant, they're at hand. California happens to be a leader in putting them into practice. Two-thirds of the electricity in California now comes from non-carbon sources, and nevertheless, California has surged to become the fourth biggest economy in the world. It's not hard to connect these dots. You need political leadership that will do it.
Mark Hertzgaard is environment correspondent for The Nation and executive director of Covering Climate Now, a global journalism initiative committed to better coverage of the climate story. And you, if you'd like to join us, what issues would you like us to cover on Your Calls One Planet series in the coming months? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255 or email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Dell in South San Francisco. Hi, Dell. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. And thank you for the show. I'm a member of a coalition trying to stop advanced manufacturing in the quarry of San Bruno Mountain. And the quarry of San Bruno Mountain is surrounded by endangered species habitat. The developers in old time Silicon Valley company that builds factories and stuff all around Silicon Valley, and they have since the 70s. They want to put an advanced manufacturing in the quarry now, and we're not sure even what that means at this point. The example the developer gave me was a computer chip factory they want to put in. And the bad thing about it is within a half mile, quarter mile of residences in the new part of Brisbane, and right near the old industrial park. They have to change the zoning in order to build this million square foot building there. And so we're lobbying the city to and the residents to become aware of this issue.
Dell, I just found a piece in the Chronicle about how this is a revised proposal that includes a data center and an advanced manufacturing facility. This piece was out in July. Is that the latest?
That's the latest from the Chronicle, yeah. But the latest from the developer is that they claim they want to build an advanced manufacturing plant only. and they lowered the footprint from 1,300,000 square feet building to 1 million square feet building with advanced manufacturing. And we're afraid that the pollution from the advanced manufacturing will affect the endangered species there.
Well, thank you so much. We'll definitely look into this. And I'm sure there's so many similar stories in other communities in California and across the country. So I just checked out this piece and we'll take a look at it. And if you have any guest ideas or any other information you'd like to share with us, please email yourcall@kalw.org. Thank you so much for the call, Del. Let's go next to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Hanging in there. Thank you. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you so much. I was responding to your guest who spoke about the how important it is to be part of a larger movement. It's not only an abstract, but rather climate activists have been... I'm hearing an echo, sorry. climate activists have been subjected to the same issues in terms of freedom of speech, surveillance. In fact, even the documentary Merchants of Doubt, which set us back more than 20 years in being able to bring to the public the information about the climate. Also, the issue of surveillance is something that touches upon everybody, including climate activists who've been subjected to police surveillance and undercover people into peace and anti-war meetings as well. Recently, Alternate put out an article regarding the use of tracking technology in cell phones that first were used, have been used with, against Palestinians, and specifically in Gaza, killing 270 journalists in 2 years, where they would track people to their homes and then bomb them there. That's the same technology used to surveil and track immigrants. And it touches upon, you know, the whole issue of our military budget and the fact that the war industry is the major climate destroyer. And this whole issue with regard to ICE is the training of our police forces by Israel, which was a report put out by Voices for Peace called Deadly Exchange, is basically bearing fruit in our streets today against people who are opposing this militarism and fascism in the streets. The issue of Palestine also comes to mind when it comes to ecology because of the water rights and the destruction of water treatment plants, and all the different things that have been happening to Palestinians now are happening to Americans on the streets every day. These killings, extrajudicial killings, have been happening for decades against Palestinians. And so I think it's important for us to really look deep in our, you know, in our hearts in the United States and see what side we've been on and how wrong we've been.
Well, thank you for that. We are going to do another show about the voice of Hind Rajab tomorrow on Your Call. We did a show about this a couple of weeks ago, and we wanted to do another one because the film is opening in the Bay Area and in other places across the country. It's the film that recreates an emergency call from a 5-year-old girl trapped in a car under fire in Gaza as responders desperately try to save her. So we're doing that tomorrow. And then you brought up a lot of information, Lisa, as you do when you call in. And I just wanted to let people know, since you brought up the law enforcement training in Israel, the Real News Network has a piece, actually just a couple days ago, U.S. sends hundreds of law enforcement to Israel to learn worst practices from IDF. There's that. Jewish Voice for Peace also has stories about this, just to let people know if they wanted some more information. Mark, taking this back to the environment, Lisa talked about the environmentalists who have been killed doing this critical work. And Global Witness keeps track of this. They found that from 2012 to 2024, 2,253 land and environmental defenders were killed or disappeared around the world, defending their land, their communities, and the environment.
Yes, it is a tragic tale and a horrifying number. And I can't pass up the opportunity to also say that journalists are being killed in unprecedented numbers, especially in Palestine in the last year. And oftentimes when journalists are trying to tell the stories of these land defenders in places like Colombia, frankly, and elsewhere in Brazil, journalists are, like the land defenders themselves, threatened with this kind of violence. And it's another reason why it is so important not to be siloed in doing this work. If you stay in a silo, your chances of success are much, much smaller than if you join with others who have similar concerns. And as I said a couple of minutes ago, there are very clear connections between, just here in the United States, if you're an American, looking at what the federal government is doing on, say, ICE, and what it is doing in climate, and what it is doing in, you know, the Federal Reserve today, and a whole lot of other areas. It's essentially an authoritarian regime that is breaking the law wantonly in service of the 1%, the very richest people. And that takes various forms. In the case of climate, it's basically denying that the planetary house is on fire. And so it's really urgent that people who are doing this work, and I know it's not easy always, but it is really urgent to try and make common cause with others. And that again, by the way, here in New York at the anti-ICE rally yesterday, that was a major theme of a lot of the speakers there, that it's really important to make common cause, including across political and ideological differences. That's a direct quote from one of the speakers. And that's sometimes hard for people. You know, you may disagree a lot and deeply about a certain issue, and yet you still are on the same side in regards to an authoritarian regime that we have in Washington. And so those are the challenges that face movements in these moments in history. And the movements, you know, history shows us that the movements that succeed are the ones that meet those challenges the best.
And we should say that there are also environmental activists in Iran that have been arrested and killed. And we are going to do a show about what's happening in Iran. According to Reuters, the latest numbers are more than 500 people in Iran have already been killed. And there have just been so many protests over the last week. So we're going to do a show about that, I believe, on Friday. And before we go to break, Mark, I wanted to ask you, what I'm hearing in the media is human-caused climate change. And that stops me in my tracks sometimes because I think human-caused climate change. I think that the oil execs probably love that term because it makes it sound like we are all equally responsible for where we are right now. So you put the oil executives, we have to talk about oil and gas, but then according to Oxfam, this piece just came out in The Guardian a couple days ago. The world's richest 1% have used up their fair share of carbon emissions just 10 days into 2026, according to Oxfam. The charity said the worst effects of the emissions would be faced by those who've done the least to cause the climate crisis, lower and middle income countries most at risk from the detrimental effects of climate change. These are the ones who are most at risk. So what are your thoughts about this term that the media is using lately called human-caused climate change?
Sure. One quick note first on Iran, though, Rose, when you do this show, the environmental situation there is really dire. And in fact, Tehran has been on the verge of running out of water, running out of drinking water for some months now. It hasn't gotten much attention in the U.S. press, but you want to look into that. That's part of what is making people desperate. And this is a make or break moment, folks, in Iran. So, you know, send them solidarity. As far as human caused climate change, that phrase, that is a reflection of the fact, it's actually compared to how it used to be described, that's an improvement. Because it used to be that the mainstream media would say climate change and, you know, we can't say whether it's what causes it, right? And so now they have moved in recent years to saying human caused. I agree with you that that still begs the question of, well, which humans exactly are we talking about? And you're quite right that it's the 1% who have been primarily responsible for this. And it's not just the 1% in income. There's also a study, I think it was Oxfam as well in this case, 91 countries, sorry, 91 corporations rather, responsible over the last 50 years for about 75% of all the carbon pollution. So again, this underscores the fact that the climate and the environmental issue cannot really be separated from the other issues facing American society and, in fact, global society. We have a situation where the rich and the powerful are gaming the system to the detriment of everyone else, whether it be in the form of ruinous cost of groceries or ruining the atmosphere for our children. So it's the same. This is why some activists say we should be naming hurricanes instead of Hurricane Dawn or Hurricane, Eveline or Hurricane Malia. We should be naming them Hurricane Exxon and Hurricane Chevron and Hurricane BP. That's not going to happen in the media, but that's would be more accurate.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. On today's Your Call, we are opening the lines to find out what you want to hear on our One Planet shows in the coming months. What is happening in your community? What stories do you think deserve more attention? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Mark Hertzgaard, environment correspondent for The Nation and executive director of Covering Climate Now. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will once again talk about the voice of Hind Rajab. It's a new film that recreates an emergency call from a 5-year-old girl trapped in a car under fire in Gaza as responders desperately try to save her. We will also talk about children in Gaza who have lost their lives, and then children in Gaza who have been wounded and who need prosthetics. There's just so much desperate need in Gaza. And we're going to talk about the organizations that are trying to help children there. And then on Wednesday, we'll continue our authoritarian playbook series, and we'll be focusing on librarians that are fighting back against book bans and the Trump administration. And then we will be hosting a live authoritarian playbook show on January 20th, from 6:30 to 7:30 at 220 Montgomery Street in San Francisco. It'll be a live authoritarian playbook show January 20th from 6:30 to 7:30, 220 Montgomery Street in San Francisco. You can find more information at kalw.org. Today, we are opening the lines to take your show ideas for our One Planet series. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We're joined by Mark Hertzgaard, environment correspondent for The Nation and executive director of Covering Climate Now. And Mark, I think we've talked about this before, but I just wanted to bring it up again. We started this One Planet series back in 2016 after that election because we thought that issues related to the planet were probably not going to get the attention they deserved with Trump coming to the White House. And it's really amazing to think here we are almost 10 years later, and various think tanks are telling Democrats not to talk about the climate crisis. But these shows and a focus on issues like whether it's plastic pollution or the shipping industry and how that affects whales, there's so much going on right now, and it just deserves so much attention. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that, and then how you have seen media coverage change over the years that you've been working with Covering Climate Now.
In fact, the reason we started Covering Climate Now in 2019 was to, as we put it, break the climate silence that prevailed throughout the media. And part of the reason for that silence is that legacy media in particular tends to follow government. not necessarily parrot what government says, but to cover the issues the government is talking about. And when, therefore, when political leaders are not talking about a given issue, the media tends not to talk about it, which of course then is a, you know, self-reinforcing cycle, because politicians then think, oh, the media is not covering it, therefore that must mean that nobody cares about it, so I can safely get away with not talking about it. And so we started covering Climate Now in 2019 to break that climate silence, and I think we helped to do that for sure. And because we pulled together a critical mass of journalists, not just in the United States, but around the world, who recognized that we were blowing it, frankly, on the climate story, and we were really betraying our civic duty, which is to inform the populace about what's going on. And we made a big improvement, I think, and then along came COVID and in 2020, and that really harmed the momentum, and it also harmed the momentum of the activists, by the way. I remember Greta Thunberg and others talking about how, well, now we can't meet in person, and that is a real handicap to doing, you know, grassroots political organizing. And so there was a decline in that kind of grassroots energy, and that too feeds a certain amount of media complacency. That said, it has gotten much, much, much worse in the last year. And we've seen, especially here in the United States, I want to emphasize that. I was just at the UN Climate Summit in Brazil in November, and our colleagues in the media around the world, especially in the Global South, continue to report on the climate story, and for obvious reasons. They're on the front lines. You do not have to convince any Global South journalist or newsroom I've ever encountered that climate change is a story worth covering. They see it all around them. In the United States, it's different. And it's largely because of the arrival of Trump. And it's not so much a case of journalists or news outlets censoring themselves, although that is clearly happening now at CBS News, but rather, again, what I said earlier, the media tends to reflect what the government at any given time is talking about. And in Trump's case, there is this fire hose of chaotic information on all kinds of different stories that are happening at the same time that I think helped to crowd climate change out of the news agenda. And that's not entirely, it's not that hard to understand that. When you've got a war in Ukraine, you've got an incredible war in Gaza, all this happening at the same time, you've got the ICE raids, you've got all these other things that are happening in the United States, there's only so many people in the newsroom. There's only so much time on the broadcast. There's only so many stories you can publish every day. And in that context, climate has definitely fallen down the agenda, I'm sorry to say. And at Covering Climate Now, we are working hard to change that, to reverse that, partly by working with the journalists who are inside of these organizations to try and help them convince their editorial superiors to recognize, for example, that, again, the vast majority of the American public wants climate news. They care about climate change. They want their government to do something. And so there is a direct commercial self-interest for journalists and newsrooms to respond to that.
I just got a breaking news alert from the New York Times, a piece by Maxine Jaslow. EPA to stop considering lives saved when setting rules on air pollution. For decades, the EPA has calculated the health benefits of reducing air pollution using the cost estimates of avoided asthma attacks and premature deaths to justify clean air rules. Not anymore. Under Trump, the EPA plans to stop tallying gains from the health benefits caused by curbing two of the most widespread deadly air pollutants, fine particulate matter and ozone, when regulating the industry, according to internal agency emails and documents reviewed by the New York Times. Well, this is devastating, Mark. One more devastating rule coming out of this administration, because as Maxine Jaslow reports, this is going to make it easier to repeal limits on pollutants from everything from steel mills to oil refineries. And that means that it's going to result in dirtier air. And according to Earth.org, air pollution from oil and gas kills about 91,000 people every year just in the United States.
Yeah, around the world, it's about 7 million people a year die from fossil fuel pollution. Maxine Joslow is an excellent reporter. She's also illustrative of this theme I was talking about earlier, of what's happening inside of the media. Maxine was at the Washington Post for many years. In fact, she was one of the two reporters who broke that incredible scoop in May of 2024, reporting that Donald Trump had told a room full of oil company CEOs, "Hey, give me $1 billion towards my campaign election campaign, and I'll basically make it worth your while once I'm in the president." So Maxine left the Washington Post partly because, and I don't know this for a fact, but it's pretty obvious that she left along with many other reporters and editors at the Washington Post after Jeff Bezos basically said, "No, we're not going to run an endorsement of Kamala Harris for 2024 presidency," and basically said, "We're going to turn over the editorial pages of the Washington Post only to pro free enterprise voices." So she's now at the New York Times. That's the New York Times' game. It's a very important story that she's just published. It's not a surprising one, however. It gets back to the thing we talked about a moment ago. This Trump administration is in service of the 1%. It's not hiding it. Previous administrations would try to hide something like this. It's the same as when Trump went into Venezuela. He doesn't bother with this stuff about, "Oh, we're defending democracy," and even the fentanyl stuff. He dropped that immediately. He was like, "Yeah, it's about the oil." So, in that context, again, this is a political risk, however, for Donald Trump. If all you do is support the 1% and it becomes increasingly obvious that that's what you're doing, and that it's increasingly obvious that you lie, which the killing of Renee Good certainly puts that out front. There are signs at this rally yesterday in New York. We have eyes, ICE. We can see for ourselves what happened there. So Trump is now in. He's getting more and more desperate, partly because you are seeing significant, small but still significant parts of the Republican Party in Congress moving away from him, challenging him, not supporting him on the Epstein files release, not supporting him on the renewal of the Obamacare healthcare subsidies. And why are those Republicans doing that? They're doing it because they can see that the November elections are going to be a bloodbath for Republicans if they continue to stay down the Donald Trump path, especially for these Republicans who are in purple or so-called swing districts. So in this moment, it's really important for people who oppose this stuff that Trump is doing not to just wallow in defeatism and say, "Oh gosh, look at it. He's done another terrible thing," and go back to doom scrolling. Important thing to do is to get out there in the streets and make alliances and talk to people and make sure that you vote these people out in November.
Today on Your Call, we're joined by Mark Hertzgaard, environment correspondent for The Nation, executive director of Covering Climate Now. We're opening the lines to find out what you want to hear on our One Planet shows in the coming months. You can call us 866-798-8255 or email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's go next to Scott in Half Moon Bay. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the show.
Morning. I just got your announcement on the EPA's ruling on air pollutants, which wasn't what I called about, but to me, the common theme in everything that the current regime is doing, it's all about money. And to ignore air pollutants as an economic cost is the height of absurdity. And so I think when we talk about a lot of climate issues, the pocketbook to the American voter is key, and this is going to be the greatest impact on people's income and their pocketbooks than anything we've ever seen before. There's nothing, with the exception of AI, which isn't here yet, that's going to be as devastating as this will be to everyone's economics, except for those people in the top 1%, because they can move away from it, they don't have to worry about it. And I think tying a lot of the stories around climate to economics is a key component of this. We can make solar electricity cheaper than virtually any other form of energy, including coal, without killing people, but we're not doing it. And we're ceding the high ground to countries like China with the technology we developed. And if that's not the height of absurdity when it comes to, you know, giving away the keys, I don't know what else is. And so I think we just need to point that out to people. But my real comment was on more stories around regenerative agriculture, which, again, when you look at companies, and particularly in South America, there's great examples in Brazil where large industrial producers of sugarcane have adopted regenerative agriculture practices, that they get far better economics than their counterparts who don't. And I think stories like that and tying things back to the pocketbook would go a long way to assuaging people from this, you know, we're going to go back to living in caves. We're not. We have the technology to do this stuff. We need to get it into the hands of the people who are willing to implement it.
Thank you so much, Scott. You make so many great points there. What are your thoughts, Mark?
Absolutely. Regenerative agriculture is booming across the global south. And part of the reason for that is not just that it's better, as the caller indicated, but as Cristiana Figueres, who was, you know, a very key architect of the 2015 Paris Agreement on climate change, Covering Climate Now did a press briefing with Cristiana in Brazil during COP30. And she talked to this very point. She said, look, and she's from Costa Rica, the reason that regenerative agriculture is booming across the global south is we don't really have a whole lot of choice. Climate change is hitting, the impacts of climate change, the droughts in particular, but also the storms, are hitting our agricultural sectors. In many global south countries, agriculture is still the dominant economic sector for the entire country. And the old way of doing things is just not working. Regenerative agriculture is particularly good at dealing with droughts because you're, instead of bombarding the soil with lots of chemicals, that can increase yields in the short term, but weakens the soil over the long term. Regenerative agriculture focuses on healthy soil. And one of the things that makes soil healthy is its ability to absorb and store rainwater. Instead of on a conventional field, and this is coming from a boy who grew up on a farm, you know, a conventional field when there's rain, because that soil has been packed down by the tractors and the type of planting that you do and harvesting that you do, the rain just flashes off and most of it never gets down into the soil and down to the roots. Regenerative agriculture is exactly the opposite. And so you can actually have, and I've reported this story in Africa, for example, where once you switch to regenerative agriculture, the underground water tables actually begin to replenish. And that is an extraordinary advantage when you're looking at much more volatile droughts, for example.
And we should say, for people who are not familiar with this, I'm reading from the NRDC here, a piece about regenerative agriculture. The holistic principle behind this system are meant to restore soil and ecosystem health, address inequities, and leave our land, waters, and climate in better shape for future generations. Arohi Sharma, who's with the NRDC, says this movement is the dawning realization among more people that an indigenous approach to agriculture can help restore ecologies, fight climate change, rebuild relationships, spark economic development, and bring joy. So that it's a really important thing to talk about. Thank you again, Scott, and we'll do a show about what's happening around regenerative agriculture soon. I want to read, we have a lot of emails, so I want to read a few of these, and then we'll take a few calls and get responses from Mark. Penny writes, what makes no sense to me with all the weather-related disasters this country has been enduring these past years, people are not up in arms regarding what the Trump regime is doing to curb any effort to stop the continued degradation. It's unbelievable that when interviews are conducted in hard-hit areas, there's no mention of climate change as the cause of these disasters. How many lives, how many homes, how much destruction do we need to lose and witness for people to express their outrage at the rollbacks and environmental solutions Trump is conducting? And you reminded me of a piece I just read in the New York Times again Under Trump, U.S. adds fuel to a heating planet. Lisa Friedman writes that last year, after Trump returned to the White House, emissions rose 1.9%, according to the federal government. So it just shows how important these policies are, that things could happen that quickly in just 1 year. Thank you for that email, Penny. Let's see. We've got Kathleen. Please cover proposed offshore drilling leases. The BOEM public comment period for the second phase of the process ends later in January. Check out the work that Save Our Shores and Santa Cruz is doing in collaboration with environmental groups on this issue. Thank you for this. So if you live in a coastal area, I just was looking up some articles here. There's going to be a number of events happening for people to voice their opposition to offshore oil drilling in California. This is really important. And if you just do a search, there's a lot of articles on this. There's one in the Chronicle just a couple days ago. Trump's plan to open California's coastline to oil drilling threatens more than ocean life. So we will definitely do a show about this and also share it with the news department because this is so important. Thank you for that, Kathleen. As Susan writes, it might be too controversial, but I wish you could talk about this. Local companies and universities that are being called out for animal cruelty. Well, thank you for that, Susan. If you can email us with some more information about the groups and the universities that are being called out, we will definitely look into that. Ruby writes, a number of friends and I have been discussing Venezuela oil executives, the demands and the delusions by Trump. Our question is, why is oil demand down worldwide? Could it possibly be the successful transition to other sources of energy and EV cars? Also, the move to reduce oil-based plastics in our lives? Or is there another answer? Mark, what are your thoughts on that? And is oil demand down?
Ding, ding, ding. The caller got it right. Yes, oil demand is down. And the analysts who study this closely say that by far the main factor is widespread adoption around the world of electric vehicles. It's now about one out of every four new vehicles sold worldwide is an electric car. That's especially true in China. So, you can do the math in your head there. That's the big part of the reason that the demand is down. That didn't stop Trump from wanting to have more oil on the market, but it certainly is causing oil executives to question this idea that Venezuela is really a good place to go and invest. And in fact, there's a spat today between Trump and the CEO of Exxon, because that CEO of Exxon said that Venezuela was, quote unquote, uninvestable.
Okay, so here's a Reuters headline. Trump says he might keep Exxon out of Venezuela after CEO called it uninvestable.
Yeah, you can see the high-minded way that our president makes policy.
Wow. What do you think this will mean, Mark, given that demand is down? And then there's an article, let me just find this headline, about fracking. U.S. frackers were already facing a global oil supply glut. Trump's Venezuelan dream could make it worse. What do you think this means for the bigger picture?
I'm always a journalist who thinks we should not be in the prediction business, we're in the reporting business, but I can analyze and report and say, look, Donald Trump still, in his mind, he wants to go back to the 1940s, 1950s, in many respects, right? And oil is a big part of that. He still thinks that, more oil and more coal, for that matter, is what drives prosperity. And he is a colossal misreading of today's global economy. And it makes, I'm sure, the Chinese very, very happy, and the Europeans for that matter, because the energy sources, in the years ahead are not going to be fossil fuels. And everybody in the rest of the world understands that except for Donald Trump. And the fight is on to see who's going to be the dominant suppliers in those areas. And in fact, at the COP30 UN Climate Summit in Brazil in November, Gavin Newsom went there with a very pointed message to the rest of the world. Look, Washington is not a reliable partner for you, but California will be. And we look forward to competing with China to provide these kinds of green technologies. So Trump is essentially, through his misguided ideology, he is steering the not just the U.S. economy, but arguably the traditional oil industry into a cul-de-sac. This is not a, this is not where you want to be investing into a country like Venezuela, which, yeah, they have a lot of reserves, but the amount of time and effort and money that will be required to really bring meaningful amounts of that to the market, it's tens of billions of dollars, rather, and many, many years before much of that oil is going to get to market.
One more email from Judy. Please cover the years-long fight for cleanup at the Naval Yard of Bayview Hunters Point in San Francisco. A number of local papers have been covering this. I hope you will cover it too. Thank you so much, Judy. We will definitely add that one to our list. We don't have time for other callers, but Harry wanted to talk about light pollution. Peter says, instead of calling the hurricanes Exxon, call them McDonald's. It's all corporations' fault, not just the oil companies. Well, thank you for those calls. And I'm just wondering, Mark, we've got about a minute or two left. What are you planning to cover in the coming months? And what are you hearing from your colleagues at Covering Climate Now?
First thing I would say is that it is a very different picture outside of the United States than in the United States. And while there is a lamentable amount of climate silence, or at least climate quiet, in many newsrooms in the U.S., that's not the case, at least as of yet, overseas. And one of the stories that I'm most interested in is actually kind of a surprise, potential, very good news outcome of the COP30 climate summit in Brazil, which famously ended with an agreement that did not even mention the words fossil fuels. Much less did the final agreement endorse what most of the world's countries were demanding at COP30, which was a quote-unquote a roadmap for a just global transition away from fossil fuels. However, that was blocked because petrostates led by Saudi Arabia and Russia exploited basically a loophole in the UN rules, which requires consensus decision-making, not unanimity, but consensus. And so you have enough, you know, a handful of petrostates were able to block that. However, there is a meeting at the end of April where 86 of the countries who want that roadmap to transition from fossil fuels, they will be getting together. And it will not be under UN rules of consensus, but rather majority rules. And they will be talking about how to phase out fossil fuels globally. And if you put all those 86 countries together, their GDPs amount to the biggest economic superpower on earth, bigger than the United States. If that amount of economic muscle withdraws its buying power from the fossil fuel industry, that could be an earthquake moving in the right direction.
Mark Hertzgaard is environment correspondent for The Nation and executive director of Covering Climate Now. Thank you so much for joining us, Mark. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
First, this news.